This is Mind Report. I'm Paul Bloom. I'm a professor of psychology and cognitive science at Yale University, and I'm delighted to be talking today to Steve Binger. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Paul.
Just to get your title correct, you are the Harvard College professor and Johnstone Family professor in the Department of Psychology at Harvard University. We've known each other for over 25 years. I should tell people that you were my one of my advisors and my teachers in graduate school. You and I wrote the first paper I've ever published together on evolution of language. And I've long been influenced by both your science and your writing over my entire career, so this is just a thrill to be talking to you today. I want to start by talking about your recent book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, which is, I think, a very important and very rich and influential book. And you make two sorts of claims in the book. One is a descriptive claim about a phenomena, and then the second is a theoretical claim or set of claims about how to explain the phenomena. So I thought maybe we could break things up into two, and I could have you start by just saying what your descriptive claim in the book is.
The descriptive claim is that violence has declined over the course of history at a variety of scales of time and of magnitude. And I divide the empirical phenomenon into six phenomena, each corresponding to a different kind of decline. And they include the decline of homicide in Western societies by a factor of about 35 since the Middle Ages, the abolition of barbaric institutions like slavery and torture executions, and witch hunts and burning heretics at the stake, which were concentrated more or less around the time of the European Enlightenment, the more recent decline of war, particularly interstate wars, wars with a government on each side, traditionally the wars that did the most damage, starting around at the end of World War II, 1945. Another decline in war, more uneven and affecting not just the big rich countries, but all countries, starting around the end of the Cold War in 1991. And then finally, the abolition, or at least the targeting of violence on smaller scales against vulnerable populations like women, children, racial minorities, even animals. Mm-hmm. Then the second part of the enterprise is to try to make sense of it all. That is, why did violence decline on so many scales of time and magnitude? It just seems uncanny. And I don't think it's that human nature has literally changed in the biological sense of a change in gene frequencies over time. I think we're pretty much the same species that we were 1,000 years ago.
So let's hold back on the theoretical claim and just zoom in on the descriptive one to start with. So the first thing I'm interested in doing is sort of aligning this with the rest of your theoretical views. I was reading a blog recently, Crooked Timber, where they had a discussion right before your book came out, and people were sort of astonished that you wrote this book, because the descriptive claim is a claim about change, and you're well known for your advocacy of evolutionary psychology, the view which I share, which is that we have these human natures that were shaped by our evolutionary history. And so there's a sense in which it's a strange book for you to write. Now they don't literally clash, the idea that there's change over history and that there's a human nature. In fact, in your earlier books in evolutionary psych, you talk a little bit about this kind of violence. You sort of anticipate this book. But it does seem like an interestingly different direction, a different sort of emphasis. And I'm wondering whether you thought of it that way as you wrote it.
Yes, there was that tension in the earlier books in which I briefly brought up the decline of violence and how the mind works and in the blank slate. And one of the reasons I brought it up in those books is that as someone who advocates the very idea of a human nature, I met with resistance to the very idea, partly from moral and political motives. Namely, if humans have a nature, including all those nasty bits like dominance and revenge and exploitation and so on, does that mean that we're doomed to perpetual strife and conflict? And does it imply that there's no point in trying to make the world a better place because people will screw it up no matter what you do? And so it seemed like a kind of reactionary, anti-progressive position. And I think that at least in part, some of the opposition to evolutionary psychology and other more or less nativist approaches to the human mind have some of that in it. And sometimes it's quite explicit. And what I brought up in those earlier books is that this was this fear is unfounded. First of all, it's unfounded because of what an evolutionary approach to human nature actually consists of, which is not that behavior itself is selected for so that there's aggressive behaviors in the genes, but rather certain emotions, drives, ways of learning and knowing. Those are our legacies for evolution, and they don't directly translate into behavior. And that's the psychology part of evolutionary psychology. Namely, it isn't behavior that's selected. Evolution can't actually pull the muscles directly, but it left its stamp on the wiring and chemistry of the brain, which gives us certain inclinations, which may or may not be externalized as behavior. And the reason that they aren't necessarily externalized is that the mind is a complicated place there. Even if we do harbor aggressive impulses, it's not the only thing that fits inside the skull. We also have faculties that can inhibit our violent tendencies, like self-control, like empathy, like reason. And what we actually do physically depends on which of these faculties gets the upper hand. So it's two of the convictions that both you and I have in cognitive science, namely that one must take a cognitive approach. We're not behaviorists. We do believe that there's contents to the mind, and a kind of modular or faculty or specialization approach, namely the mind doesn't consist of one thing, but a number of sometimes competing faculties. Both of those furnish the psychology that lies behind better angels of our nature. And in fact, the title itself, which comes from Abraham Lincoln, is a pretty direct acknowledgement of a faculty psychology, using the poetic biblical term mm-hmm. angels, but to refer to one particular or one set of faculties in the mind, but not the only ones.
You can imagine taking that in directions other than violence. So, for instance, there's a lot of evolutionary psychology work on sexual desire and the difference between sexual desire and sexual activity for men and women, what men and women are interested in, and so on. And you can imagine then making the same argument for that, saying, look, there's an evolutionary history, but then again, we're modular creatures, we have separate faculties, and that too could change. I mean, how far would you push it? Are there things that we would never be able to rebel against? Are there aspects of human nature that, unlike violence, aren't going to change?
I think that there are aspects of our mental lives that are not going to change, but our behavior can change a fair amount within those boundaries. It's interesting you brought up sexuality, because around the time that you and I were working on our paper on language, a visitor to Cambridge was Donald Simons, who wrote the book Evolution of Human Sexuality, which had quite a brilliant introductory chapter. His book was written in 1979, and it challenged the main idea of the sociobiology at the time, that evolution could illuminate behavior. And he said, behavior, it's all over the place. The anthropologists are right that if you go from society to society, all kinds of strange things can happen. Where you really want to go to find universals is in emotion and in desires and in mental life. And he argued that sexuality was a prime example of that, that while sexual mores and customs might vary, sexual desire might vary a whole lot less. And I remember my own kind of touchstone for this was our President Jimmy Carter at the time, who confessed to Playboy magazine that he committed adultery in his heart many times,
yes.
Almost cost him the presidency. As far as we know, he never committed it in the flesh. But the fact that as this Sunday school teacher, this moralistic, you know, preachy kind of guy, nonetheless had the same mental life as various sleazes who acted on it, I think vindicates Simon's on sexuality and does have a spillover to violence. In fact, I mentioned one in the book, which is that if you try to manipulate people's powers of self-control by fatiguing it, as Roy Baumeister would put it, then you get people, at least in their imaginations, being much less inhibited, both in terms of what they think they would do sexually and what they would do in terms of committing violence, than if they're in full control of themselves. So it's almost as if you could somehow nullify self-control, you'd get much closer to our natures than if you just let people do their own thing.
I mean, you can make another case would be food, which actually connects to violence in different ways, but I guess the argument would be, we're never really going to lose our taste for meat. You can, you know, unless we redesign our genes or something. However, we might choose not to eat it, or choose to eat certain sorts of meat. We might choose to change our eating habits in accord with our sort of better angels, though the desires themselves won't change substantially.
Yes, as we've done already, even those of us who aren't vegetarians still avoid all kinds of foods that we perceive as unhealthy. And it can feed back into certain emotions and drives. If there are, say, critical periods in which we fine-tune our tastes for foods, for example, if you withhold a certain food from children during that critical period, that might be a way of, and do so for moral or self-control reasons, that might cause some longer-term retuning of the tastes.
Right. I've always been interested in what you call self-binding, which is changing your environment in the future to sort of block certain possibilities, like when you set a timer that you can't use the internet for some period of time. And it's interesting the extent to which we could use some sort of techniques to block our own desires. If there was a way, for instance, since I'm actually been convinced that most meat eating is immoral, but it's nonetheless I eat it. If there's a way for me to like meat less, I would choose that option.
Yes, right.
So,
I know. At least you and I both have the exalted moral status of thinking that we ought not to eat meat, even if we do.
I'm sure that's very reassuring to the animals.
Yes, this is, I mean, sometimes called Ulyssian or Odyssean self-control,
yes,
after the great story of Odysseus having himself tied to the mast so he could resist the siren songs. That's one of the ways in which one part of the brain can outsmart the other. And yet another illustration of why, you know, you and I agree that some kind of modular understanding of cognition is essential to understanding human behavior.
Of course, it's complicated because I have a program on my computer called Freedom, and I type in a certain amount of time. Internet time is just off my internet, but it can't stop me though from running to my iPad and checking my email.
Right.
And also can't make me use the machine in the first place. So I actually need a meta program that forces me to constrain myself using that program. So to go back, you pointed out that in some way the idea of an invariant human nature is unpopular. But one thing I've discovered, and I'm certain you've discovered too, is For many people, the idea of the changes that you're talking about, where it's just the decline of violence over time, is seen as surprising. Many people are just kind of stunned to hear that the last century was not the bloodiest century of all human history, that things are not the worst now than the worst that they've ever been, but also maybe morally troubling. And I wonder if you have sort of a diagnosis of why that's so.
Yes, and it's, again, we as psychologists, we get to kind of go meta and try to understand the reason for particular belief systems. Certainly in the case of people not appreciating how much violence has declined, I think that Tversky and Kahneman's exploration of the availability bias, namely we judge risk by how easy it is to recall examples, particularly vivid, gory examples that lodge in memory. And as long as the rate of violence worldwide has not fallen to zero, it probably never will fall to zero, because news is about stuff that happens, not stuff that doesn't happen, there are always going to be enough examples to fill the evening news. And if you get your sense of the risk of the world from the news, you're going to think that violence is as prevalent as ever. In fact, more prevalent, because now anyone with a cell phone is an instant reporter. They can beam color video footage all over the world pretty much in real time. So we're better and better at detecting the violence that occurs. In the past, it may have been a tree falling in the forest with no one to hear it. But now it's you can't avoid it. And I think that does distort people's sense. It's only when you look at statistics that have a denominator, namely how many countries are not at war, how many people don't get killed, that you can spot the huge decline that's taken place. And there's also a bit of our moral psychology that I think gets engaged, and more and more you've been exploring our moral psychology. But there is a component of it that if you are burnishing your moral credentials, if you're a moral entrepreneur, then you're almost forced to say that we're in a crisis, that imminent action is necessary to prevent even a greater crisis. And it's almost as if you say things are getting better, there's a worry that you lull people into complacency. Who's going to join your crusade if you say, well, things have been getting better by themselves? And so I think there's pressure to shut up about good news lest you scare away potential supporters.
So the flip side of complacency is, I guess, fatalism, where if you think that, say, the situation in Africa is horrible, it's always been horrible, if anything, it's getting worse, you might say, look, there's no point in doing anything. You know, some version of the poor will always be with us. And to some extent, hearing that changes are happening and good changes are happening can, from a moral entrepreneur standpoint, motivate people to help because they realize that actually help, you know, can happen. So you sort of have to, if you were forgetting about the truth for a moment and talking about what news you'd give to most inspire moral action, you wouldn't say the problem's solved, but at the same time, you might say, look, there's been some improvement and we can continue along those lines.
Exactly. No, I think that is a profoundly important point. I completely agree.
Let me, actually I wanted to ask you, so you make a lot of claims about the decline of violence across very, very different domains. And there's a couple of ones I wanted to press you on, but I want to ask you, what do you feel of all the claims in your book, what do you feel is sort of the strongest? I mean, I would guess it might be homicide because that's there, the data is sort of most direct. What do you think is the strongest? And then what are you sort of most tentative about? What do you sort of say you might be proven wrong about?
Certainly, homicide, I think that the data are pretty clear and pretty much every medieval historian agrees that that those times were far more violent than the present. The abolition of barbaric practices like disemboweling people who criticize the king and burning heretics at the stake, you know, that's pretty well established as well. There are people who will dispute the claim that slavery is has been abolished because of the existence of human trafficking, but I think that's just statistically illiterate. Even the world's foremost activist for eliminating the remaining traces of slavery, Kevin Bales, insists that we've never had a period in history in which a smaller proportion of the world's population has been enslaved, or in which it's as universally decried. The fragile claim is certainly the what I call the new peace, the fact that since around 1990, the rate of death from wars all over the world, from civil wars, from insurrections, has been going down. And that is... It's more fragile because, as we see in Syria, as we see in Congo, Democratic Republic of the Congo, things can get worse more easily than, say, anyone would introduce a bill in Congress re-legalizing slavery, or we go back to the Middle Ages where people would cut off each other's noses in the middle in an argument. Or we throw virgins into volcanoes. I think it's pretty safe to say that we're not going to do that. But could things get worse in the Congo? Yeah, they could get worse.
Yeah, and right, your main view wouldn't be entirely falsified if, you know, Iran nukes Israel and then all of a sudden there's a full-blown war. That's in some way a different sort of counterexample than all of a sudden America decides to throw virgins into the fire.
Yes, right.
The second is very unlikely because your psychological claim is pretty strong. We have a different attitude towards certain things. While war is something where the activity of war is more tenuously connected to our psychologies and it could erupt even if you're right in the main. Let me ask about two cases. One is to go back to animals, which is I'm actually convinced that our sentiments towards animals, towards non-human animals, are nicer than they've ever been. There are, you know, vegetarians, people care about factory farming and so on. But there, I think because of the technology, And because the technology is to some extent sequestered from the rest of our lives, the situation for non-human animals has gotten, has not entirely, maybe it's getting better now, but over the scope of human history has not been improving. To put it another way, you often give a statistical argument of sort, would you rather be a human now or a human in the 1500s or a human in 1000 BC? And if I would be a pig or a cow or a chicken, I would probably rather be one in the year 1000 than the year now. Not because people are crueler now, but because now we have millions of animals being treated through factory farming.
Yeah, no, I think that's an excellent point. And the in relating statistics of harm to attitudes and norms, in general they track each other, but this is
right.
Probably a case in which they don't. So, for example, the you could go to the movies and watch all of this simulated violence, people getting shot and blown up, and then at the end of the movie it says no animals were harmed in the making of this motion picture, even if tens of thousands of virtual people were. So that advertises a particular widely held sentiment, but you're right, we don't inquire too closely into where our chicken McNuggets came from. And part of it, of the non-moral cause of the increase in the number of animals who suffered is what's sometimes called the broiler chicken revolution, namely that starting in the 1960s, people turned from beef to chicken because they, first of all, thought it was healthier. And also people have this vague and probably unjustified sense that the chickens are somehow less conscious than cows. But it takes 200 chickens to provide the same amount of meat as one cow. And so when you never think of it this way, but when you switch from hamburger to chicken, you're multiplying by 200 the number of sentient beings that are brought into existence and live an unhappy life. And I think that has been one of the drivers, despite the fact that regulations to improve the fate of animals and vegetarianism and laboratory regulations for the safeguarding of animals have all been increasing, even if, as you say, probably more miserable chickens now than there used to be.
The second case study I was thinking about is America and violence in America. So you present a lot of evidence of violence in America since the founding of America has dropped to a staggering degree. But if you compare us now to, say, 1850 or 1900, by some statistics, our amount of, say, homicide has gone up. I mean, it's gone up and down and varies, but according to the Sunday Reservation Department of Justice, there was about one homicide per 100,000 people in the 1900s, and right now there's about four. And we're doing pretty well relative to where we were 20 years ago, but what we haven't seen is a drop. So why, and we're above, of course, we're worse than European countries in the extent of our violence. So what's wrong with us? Why have we been immune to these processes?
Right. Well, if you, one of the problems with the statistics in the United States is they just don't go back very far because until the 30s, the federal government didn't keep homicide statistics. It was up to the states, and many of them were pretty slapdash about the records. So even around 1900, I think now criminologists tend to adjust those records up by a lot. So I think they're never as low as one. Although you're right, they were certainly not much higher, if at all, than they are today. And so over the course of the 20th century, there were so many zigs and zags up and down that one couldn't say that there was a decline over the course of the 20th century. There was a decline. If you go back to the earliest records of homicide in different parts of the United States, which you have to do because the country was settled so heterogeneously. And here I rely on records from Randolph Roth from his book American Homicide. The earliest records of every place show rates of homicide at least 10 times higher than what we find today. That is New England before in colonial times, the Virginia and the coastal South, then the mountainous South, the kind of Appalachia and hillbilly country, Texas, later still Arizona and New Mexico, the ranching areas of California. All in the earliest points at which data exist, they're all sky high. And they come down, although not to the levels of civilized places like Europe, where they are in the neighborhood of 1 to 2 per 100,000 per year. In the U.S., they came down from the hundreds down to between 5 and 15, and that's where they've kind of bounced around. And so the question is, what's different about the U.S.? Partly you have to disaggregate the United States because the South is much more violent than the North, South and Southwest, than the North and the coasts. And there's also a black-white gap, which is independent of the North-South gap. And I think part of it, the simplest answer is that until recently, a lot of the United States was still in a state of anarchy. And because the U.S. is a democracy, as soon as government came, people who had already cultivated a culture, a sense of honor and a right to self-defense, they kind of had to living in anarchy. Well, once government came around, they were wanted to reserve to themselves the right of self-defense instead of outsourcing it to the government. And when you have individuals being their own judge, jury, and executioner, you're bound to have higher rates of violence than if you have a disinterested third party, namely the government. In Europe, the government pretty much pacified and brutalized the people, and then the people made it democratic, by which time they'd gotten used to the idea that the government protects them. But in the U.S., we were more or less democratic from the start, and our cultural adaptation to anarchy is something that, at least in the South and West, people weren't willing to give up.
Well, put it this way. If you look at the last 100 years, you look at the data you report in your book, You look at either the United States as a whole, or you look at, say, cities like Boston or New York, or I've looked at New Haven where I live. What you see is a very recent decline, but the overall graph isn't one of a line going down. It's of a zigzag. It shoots up in the late 60s. It goes down. It goes up. And maybe I could ask a question about your projection. We've seen a recent decline in violence over the last 10, 20 years. Do you see this as just another zigzag, that's just another random moving up and down? Or do you see this as the beginning of a trend that'll bring us down to European levels?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the other possibility is that it will kind of hover in between at the level that we have now, never quite getting down to Iceland or Denmark, but better than it was in the battle days of the 70s and 80s when you had Escape from New York and the Warriors and Hill Street Blues and all of those shows in which ever-present violence was a backdrop.
We both spent those years in Canada, so we saw
that. Right. Yeah, so we escaped the worst of it. It's true. I doubt that it'll go back up to what it was in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, namely 10 per 100,000 per year. Now it's between 4 and 5 per 100,000 per year. Mm-hmm. Partly because at that time, when it looked like everything had spun out of control and people had lost the confidence that there was anything you could do about street crime, it was considered intractable, that until you eliminated poverty and racism, and you know, who knows when that'll be, you just have to live with high levels of crime. Then starting in the 90s, the violent crime rate plummeted, and it probably wasn't because racism and inequality vanished, but it was things probably like better policing and police working in more consultation with local communities. Certainly incarceration must have had something to do with it, just physically removing crime-prone people from the streets, even if it went way, way, way overboard. And I don't think people are going to be willing to slide back into the high rates of crime of the 70s and 80s now that they know that it's no longer necessary. Now, we're living with an unfortunate side effect of that, namely over-incarceration. But what I don't think will happen is that people will go back to the days when you couldn't walk in Times Square or Central Park.
Yeah. Though I guess in some way that's a different sort of potential counterexample, which is to the extent unjust incarceration is a form of violence, and I think you would agree that it is, that has gone up in recent years.
In the United States, yes.
So yeah, in the United States and Russia, I guess, and some other countries.
Yeah, so some of it was a response to the increase in crime in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And so part of that rise has made other people safer from violence. Women can walk in the streets and be much less likely to be raped. The rate of rape has fallen by about 80% since the 1970s. And part of that explanation is that rapists have been behind bars, so it's one kind of violence preventing another. But it's also clear that the U.S. has gone way overboard and that there are drug dealers and petty criminals that also get thrown in jail too. So in that sense, there has been a reversal, because that surely is a kind of violence.
So now we're starting to shift to the second half of your book, which is more psychology, less history, less political science. I think it's fascinating in many ways, where you talk about the mechanisms that have led to the decline of violence. And one of the many interesting things about the discussion is it's not what you think they are, which is, if someone had asked me, I would have assumed that that violence will drop as poverty drops, as income difference drops, and other things. But you point to other factors, and I wondered if you could talk briefly about that.
Yes, and that many criminologists say that the big lesson from the great American crime decline starting in 1992 is that you don't have to have a revolution in wealth distribution and social arrangements for crime itself to drop. The crime can be a localized problem that can be addressed with better policing and other measures. So I think among the generic causes, ones that I would apply in different measure to the six different declines that I try to document, psychologically, one of them is increased exercise of the faculty of self-control. That is, you just you still have the impulse to throttle someone, but you count to 10 and you stifle it. And that, I think, can be a downstream consequence of more effective law enforcement. Though it also probably comes from a general sense that the social order is legitimate. It's not as if we have police snipers on every rooftop or Big Brother watching us all the time. Some of the inhibition from violence has to be purely internal. So it has to be some kind of knock-on consequence from imposition of law and order, including perhaps the confidence that the other guy is also being deterred by the Leviathan, and so you don't have to be constantly prove that you are so mean and tough that other people won't mess with you. Another psychological faculty that I think has been increasingly engaged is empathy, that as the world becomes more cosmopolitan, as we experience life through the eyes of other people, it's a little harder to dehumanize and demonize them, and maybe you lose your taste for genocide and grisly torture when you imagine that other people have minds like yours. I think there's been an expansion of reason, something that you've written about with David Pizarro and on your own, that there's certain moral arguments that become overwhelming and that people accept and eventually become second nature, but after they have been forced to confront them with their cognitive processes. And the expansion of literacy, schooling, dissemination of history, of news, it changes people's belief in terms of what's justified and what isn't, and it reframes violence from a contest that you have to win to a problem that afflicts everyone that you try to solve.
I guess it sounds plausible, and it makes me wonder about what you call a Mad Max question. So there are two factors here you talk about that reinforce one another. One is our psychologies are different. We have different attitudes. Say, I have a different attitude than I would have had a few hundred years ago about blacks, about gay people, about men and women, about torturing animals. I'm far less violent in my appetites and my desires and what I'll accept. But then the second thing is I also live in a society where there's Leviathan, there's laws, there's restraints. And to some extent, these are mutually reinforcing. The fact that our psychologies work that way explains why we have the laws we do. And the fact that we have the laws we do kind of explains why our psychologies work that way. I mean, the Mad Max question is, what would we do if the society was taken away from us? What if we do, if I look out my window, I see mushroom clouds coming from, you know, New York and Washington, and then our society collapses. How robust do you think our enhanced moral psychologies will be in the absence of external controls?
Okay, very good. Yeah, so you and I are Montrealers, and we both grew up proud of our low rate of violence. And the question is it because Montrealers are more polite and civilized, or is it also because we knew that the police were watching our back? Well, another trait of life in Quebec is that the public service unions periodically go on strike, including the police one day in 1969, and that kind of gives you a kind of controlled experiment. And sad to say for the reputation of Montrealers, within a few hours there was widespread looting and rioting and vandalism, and not one but two homicides within a span of a few hours before the Mounties were brought in to restore order.
Okay.
So that part of we lived through a bit of Mad Max. Whether we would go back to throwing virgins into volcanoes or burning heretics at the stake, that I doubt. But in terms of street crime, I think there is some fragility there.
You might be right, though. There's maybe a rosier view, which is that there's tremendous human difference, and there is some percentage of people, say psychopaths, for instance, are just, you know, really bad people, and they need the police. They are restrained only by the police. They are restrained only at the idea of being caught and being arrested. And I guess what the statistic one would want to know for something like the Montreal case is, did incidents of domestic violence, say, go up across the board, or were these actions committed by a small minority of people who were delighted the police were no longer on the job?
Yes, I suspect that it was the latter, although there can be some spiraling, a positive feedback loop, because there are probably other people who are not inherently violent, but will rise to the occasion if they think they're living in a violent environment and that their only option for safety is to, you know, do it to them before they do it to you, to be prepared to retaliate, to prove to others that you're tough enough that you will retaliate. Those are things that people who aren't psychopaths might have to cultivate in an environment that has a lot of psychopaths, or at least a lot of psychopaths that are undeterred by the police.
Right. So if the psychopaths start getting their way, they'll diminish the morality of the rest of us who have to contend with them, and then things will spiral downwards.
Exactly. And I think that's why a number of violent statistics seem so chaotic and hard to predict. They kind of go up and down when everyone least expects them to. No one predicted the 1960s crime boom. There was economic expansion. There was expansion of civil rights. There was much less inequality than we have now, but crime went through the roof. And then in the 1990s, every expert predicted that it would get even worse, and the bottom fell out. And you know, I wonder if some of the trends, both up and down, that no one can explain come from this self-reinforcing dynamic of violence.
Yeah. So there's the Leviathan, there's custom. So you talked about empathy, and one of the things that was you argue, and I think it's convincing, that empathy plays a huge role in expansion of the moral circle, expansion of concern, and consequently the decline of violence. But you're actually skeptical about empathy, and I since I am too, I'd like to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I know. It's not comfortable to be against empathy. It's kind of like being against love or motherhood. But empathy can only go so far. And there is a passage from Adam Smith's Theory of the Moral Sentiments that both of us have savored. And I know from prior conversations this is one of your favorite books as well. But he gives a thought experiment, almost a modern version of earlier version of a trolley problem, mm-hmm. where to illustrate the limits of empathy and compassion as forces for moral progress, that I think is brilliant. And he starts off by saying, imagine you read of in the paper of some disaster, say a million people were killed in an earthquake in China. You know, be honest, how would you react? You'd be upset, you'd fret, you'd reflect on the fragility of human life. And then, you know, you'd probably put the paper down and have dinner and, you know, check your email, watch TV, and it wouldn't really affect you that much.
He ends by saying you would sleep soundly that night.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, as if nothing had happened. Yeah. Whereas if you were in an accident and your hand got mangled and your little finger had to be amputated, you probably wouldn't be able to get it out of your mind. So that makes us sound, you know, that sounds like a very dark and cynical picture of humanity. But he continues and he says, well, let's change the comparison now. Now it becomes a trolley problem. Let's say you had the choice between having your little finger cut off or a million people in China die. What would you choose? And he predicts, and someone should do this experiment, maybe, because I'm speculating on the answer as he did, that no decent person would they put their little finger over a million Chinese, even if the loss of a little finger causes more emotional distress than the loss of a million Chinese. And that suggests that some power of reason, that is, when we have to justify a choice, what choice do we make, has to be potent in human affairs.
It seems right. It seems the proximate psychological mechanisms that go on in that intuition, which is, I think, pretty strong, are interesting. You could imagine that people are simply driven to that feeling that they should make this, they should sacrifice the little finger based on some pure exercise of reason. I think Smith talks a little bit about this. There's probably the emotions of maybe that of shame or guilt or anticipated guilt. He talks about impartial spectator and uses the term in different ways, but when I imagine being faced to make that decision and imagine the idea of choosing to save my finger and kill millions of people, I see other people. I would feel ashamed to do that. And I would feel ashamed even if nobody knew, because in some way, one thing that reason gives us is a little person in our head judging our consequences from an objective point of view.
Yes, the inhabitant of the breast, he called it,
yes,
in the flowery language of the 18th century. But yes, and I guess the question is, does that person have to, do we have to worry that there's a real person who will find out what our choice is, or does the homunculus, the inhabitant of the breast, suffice? And you know, that might vary from one person to another, but it's certainly a capability that we all have to, even if we know that no one will find out, to act as if someone might find out.
That's right. I mean, another sort of limitation of empathy, so empathy won't get you there. Another limitation of empathy is that it drives us to do some moral response at the expense of others. Dan Batson has an experiment where he talks about a girl, and she's in line to get some sort of organ transplant that will save her life. And when you get people to be empathetic towards her, they agree to move her up ahead of everybody else. But of course, that's wrong. There's a fair procedure in place, and you're being biased for one person over another. And empathy, when it comes to certain decisions of statistical consequence and global consequence, really something like global warming, empathy fails us.
Yeah, that's true.
And, it's hard to drive an emotional response about global warming. You know, you talk about penguins or something. But if you said, look, in order to have a carbon tax, you're going to put some poor guy out of his job, I can imagine what it's like to be some poor guy. I can't imagine what it's like. The consequences of global warming, since they're in the future and they're abstract and they're statistical, are much harder to resonate with.
Yes, I mean, you have to visualize some Bangladeshi with his farm under 6 inches of salt water 50 years from now, which is harder to do than the guy next door who's going to lose his job in the coal mine. It's true. And another example is one of the forces that saps vibrant societies all over the world, namely corruption. Well, the term corruption and the mental model of an impurity or damage kind of hides the fact that what corruption really is at the psychological level is being nice to your friends and relatives. You give your knucklehead nephew the job instead of some stranger, or you pay a fave someone's been nice to you, so you reward him with a perk or a job. We have the psychologically unnatural policy of fiduciary rules and formal regulations. You have to advertise for a job, hire the best possible candidate, even if they've never been nice to you. We now know abstractly at a cognitive level that that's necessary for societies to flourish, but it means turning off your empathy or forcing other people to turn off their empathy.
I mean, in another case, it brings us back to animals. So you know, we can imagine you and I sitting over our chicken McNuggets, you know, bemoaning how people are cruel to their dogs. And because dogs elicit empathy, but chickens typically don't. And so we could be horrifically brutal to all sorts of creatures, but not the cute ones. No one's going to eat a panda. But, you know,
right.
but we're fine with pigs and cows and so on. And so the morality that ends up with an empathy-only policy is I think, you know, horribly skewed. I mean, this gets us into moral psychology more generally, which is a field that you've contributed a lot to. And one thing which I've wrestled with, and I'm curious what your view is, do you think that the sort of work we do as psychologists, studying the grounds of moral decision-making and so on, could have normative consequences? So it could not only tell us, everybody agrees we could figure out with luck what's going on when people make moral decisions, but do you think our work could tell us what moral decisions we should make, what's right and what's wrong?
Not mechanically, but I would tend to think they are relevant. And one example is, when do you discount some deeply held conviction that might be explicable by quirks of our evolved psychology, but that ought to be given no moral weight? My colleague Josh Green has argued that some intuitions that motivate deontological conclusions in moral dilemmas, like sacrificing one person to save five if you do it with your bare hands but not if you do it indirectly, might be a case where our moral intuitions are warped by some kind of evolved psychology, and there may be other cases like that.
So we both have domains we've worked on, which I think fall into that category. I've always been interested in disgust and arguing that the evolutionary history of disgust, as well as its actual history in human society, suggests it's a very unreliable moral guide, and we should reject it. You actually have written quite an article which got some strong responses in the New Republic on dignity.
Oh, yes, right.
Dignity is a moral mistake. And so since we're against, you know, motherhood and empathy, why don't you take a shot at dignity and say what's wrong with that?
Yes, and I was asked to testify before George W. Bush's Presidential Council on Bioethics, which was stacked with people who wanted to use a concept of dignity to motivate the banning or the restriction of research that would seem to make everyone better off on utilitarian considerations. Stem cell research using embryonic stem cells would be an example, and others might be manipulations to enhance cognition and personality, measures that might extend life. Your first reaction would be, well, who could possibly be against those? If a number of people are better off and no one's worse off, what grounds could there be for opposing them? And the idea on this council was that you should oppose them because they might be affronts to human dignity. Mm-hmm. An example might be if you grew human organs in a dish, or an ultimate sci-fi scenario, what if you could somehow grow entire bodies without brains to supply you with replaceable organs, and no one was suffering, but would that be an affront to dignity and therefore something you would oppose even if it had helped people and didn't hurt anyone? And my response is that dignity, conceived of as just a reaction that we have to certain states of affairs, shouldn't be given a whole lot of weight. Not that it should be given zero weight, but we already undergo many compromises to dignity. Certainly when we allow ourselves to be probed by a doctor with a rubber glove on over his digits, when we put on those silly hospital johnnies, when we allow Homeland Security to slide a wand up our crotch. Dignity is a fine thing, but we often sacrifice it for greater goods. It can even be overused, as when people preserve their authority by maintaining an aura of dignity, and a lot of political satire is deliberately designed to puncture dignity. So dignity, I argue, should not be sacrosanct. It is it's not something that we should completely blow off, because basically the psychological response of dignity is triggered by certain perceptual cues like composure, maturity, cleanliness, propriety, and in turn it triggers a response to respect and safeguard the interests of that person. So that's not something you want to toss out the window, because it can engage our psychology to get one person to respect another. And on the other hand, it is a psychological response, and if it's a question of compromising our dignity but making people live longer and healthier, then to hell with dignity, or so I argued.
I find that convincing, but I think there are harder cases for that view. So I'm thinking about cases which are often used to argue against certain utilitarian perspectives. Suppose we're in a situation where the poor people of the world would agree to sell their organs or sell themselves into slavery to the rich people of the world. And the rich people are happy with this, and the poor people actually will voluntarily choose to do this. They're not coerced. Still, I think that there's some validity and intuition that this is a bad state of affairs, because we are stripping people of their dignity in part. Do you find it all convincing?
Well, not the slavery part, because you are there's a greater principle that may render dignity irrelevant, which is autonomy. If you give people informed consent over things that affect them, that kind of wipes away a lot of the problematic cases that have been ascribed to violations of dignity. Now, it certainly subsumed the selling yourself into slavery, which by definition means that you permanently surrender autonomy, which you can never exercise again. And so it's self-contradictory in this kind of thought experiment. A bit more troubling would be, say, the voluntary sale of kidneys, for example, where they're, on the whole, I think I'm not opposed to it, but I can imagine it in more extreme cases where you might want to put in universal restrictions on people's autonomy for some kind of greater good.
Yeah, I mean, I actually agree with that case. I would be in favor of a regulated market in kidneys. I think the benefits would be huge. But I'm also sort of sensitive to risk, and there's something disturbing about it, and I'm not sure whether my disturbing feel is something I should, as a psychologist, as a consistent psychologist, dismiss as a form of irrationality or try to look deeper into it. I take it, you never come out and say this, but I take it by the end of the book, when you're talking about decline of violence and other different moral systems, that you in the end are a consequentialist?
Yeah, except insofar as there might be general universal principles that are ultimately beneficial in their consequences. And I suppose that, I guess in the dark, that would be kind of rule utilitarian instead of act utilitarian. But yeah, if there was some principle that didn't, in the long run and when followed by everyone, had no beneficial consequences for human welfare, I don't think I would sign on to it. And I think there's sometimes when being a good deontologist might yield the greatest utilitarian benefits over the long term.
Right. So those sort of cases are, we might, as a consequentialist, might say torture is sometimes the right thing to do because the life saved or outbalance the pain that's caused. But you might also say consistently you should have an absolute rule saying no torture, because we're just better off consequences-wise with that absolute rule, though in specific cases it might lead to less optimal consequences.
Yeah, that kind of argument, exactly.
I just wanted to end by sort of getting to a couple of broader things. I mean, one broader thing is what strikes me as interesting and different than the way things were 10 years ago is that the sort of discussions we're having now about violence, about evolution, about human nature, about morality, have this sort of very broad public nature where there's a lot of very talented science writers, maybe some less talented science writers writing about this. Everything's on, you know, we're doing this, right, to be self-referential, but we have, you know, blogging heads and all the things that weren't available. Do you think this is mostly to the good? I mean, I can point out specific instances where it's not to the good, where things get corrupted, where there's pressure for psychologists and other scientists to come out with pithy, dramatic findings, which may not be true, in order to please the Twitterverse. Mm-hmm. But I also see positive things. I'm curious where you stand on this.
Yeah, on the whole, I would agree that it is positive. And I think a more psychologically self-aware society is one that's better off. That is, that we, if we get in the habit of questioning our own convictions, our own reactions, our gut feelings, I think that's to the good, because and at a variety of scales, like the thirst for retribution in the judicial system. Is it really, when we throw all those people in jail, how much of that lowers the crime rate, and how much of it is we just have that feeling that they ought to be punished? If our nation is insulted and we itch to go to war, how much of that is testosterone poisoning, and how much of it is rationally justifiable? I tend to think that some of the change in sensibilities of the post-war period is the fact that we're living in an age of psychology where we have concepts like testosterone poisoning and alpha males and pissing contests and so on, which kind of gives us a whole category to explain away a lot of behavior that in earlier times might have been seen as manly honor and dignity and just self-evidently correct. And there may be other examples where the dissemination and proliferation of psychology might encourage self-reflection that might bubble up to decision makers and leave us better off, because we have to justify what we do instead of acting on instinct.
That's interesting, because it's a sort of unfashionable sentiment. There's a lot of people who complain that the normal language of morality and responsibility and blame has been, you know, replaced, at least in certain public forums, with the language of neuroscience and psychology, where, you know, we no longer talk about this, you know, about minds and decisions. We talk about neurons firing and neural networks and parts of the brain and so on. And I think a lot of people worry that this is actually a bad thing in the main, because it, among other things, diminishes the sort of, to the extent we have a spiritual or transcendent value, it takes away from it.
Yes, there's a practical concern of what Dan Dennett calls creeping exculpation. No one is guilty of anything, because it's their genes, it's the Twiggies they ate, it's the testosterone, there's a pixel in a brain scan. But in practice, you don't really see a huge numbers of people going free because of Twinkie defenses and fMRI excuses. If anything, we're living through this incarceration boom. So that's a fear that does not seem to, an event that hasn't materialized.
Okay. And I should just end by asking you if you could just very briefly talk about your next book.
Oh, yes. And now for something completely different.
Yeah, this is a different topic.
I tend to alternate books on language with, again, the field that both you and I have started off specializing in, with books on human nature more broadly conceived. And so I'm due for another book on language, and this one's going to be a style manual. That is, can we take what we like to think we've learned about how language works and how the mind works, and translate that into better advice for how to write well, how to avoid academies and bureaucraties and legalese, how to write more gracefully and clearly, respecting the cognitive processes of readers who've got to digest your prose.
Awesome. So it would just be a sort of book that you know, if prior to me writing my next book, I wanted to write like you, or just write well, I would pick it up. We could use it as something, as a practical guide.
Well, you're the last person who would need it, but there are many of our colleagues who will remain unnamed who sure could use it.
So you can just send it out anonymously.
That's right. Not to make any hints, but a good Christmas present for some people.
Well, now that we're starting to diss our colleagues, we should bring this to an end. Thanks a lot for talking with me.
It's my pleasure, Paul. Thanks so much for having me on.
Bye.